when we were outside, when they were about to begin the sleep-in overnight, demanding that Kamala Harris allow a Palestinian-American to speak, you were there. And then the next day, and you wrote a piece in Vanity Fair about your experience, a Palestinian-American's place under the Democrats' big tent, the piece looking at the uncommitted movement and their unsuccessful efforts to have such a speaker. This is Rura Roman of the Uncommitted Movement. She's a Palestinian-American Georgia state representative. This is part of what she would have said if she was chosen.
For 320 days, we've stood together demanding to enforce our laws on friend and foe alike to reach a ceasefire and the killing of Palestinians, free all the Israeli and Palestinian hostages, and to begin the difficult work of building a path to collective peace and safety. That's why we are here. Members of this Democratic Party committed to equal rights and dignity for all. What we do here echoes around the world. They'll say this is how it's always been, that nothing can change. But remember, Fannie Lou Hamer shunned for her courage, yet she paved the way for an integrated Democratic Party. Her legacy lives on, and it's her example we follow.
So that's Georgia State Representative Rua Roman. And needless to say, there was not a Palestinian-American voice on the stage. Last night, Kamala Harris did an interview with 60 Minutes. At least they played it last night. This is what she had to say about Israel-Palestine.
When we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is, without any question, our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks. Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop in terms of putting that pressure on Israel and in the region, including Arab leaders.
That's Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris speaking on 60 Minutes last night. As we wrap up, you were just talking about Trump. Talk about what the position of the Biden-Harris administration is right now. They did hold two separate commemorations yesterday. President Biden was at the White House, and he lit a candle and also, I think, crossed himself right after. And Kamala Harris, the vice president in the Naval Observatory, planted a tree, a pomegranate tree.
Well, and, you know, that's good and appropriate, you know. Like I said, you know, we don't want to have a politic that does not take life serious and does not take loss of life serious. On the larger question, and maybe even as an extension of that, but we have to take all life seriously. I don't think we're doing that. This is morally untenable. What I saw was, and this is the first time I've ever said this or put this in this frame, and maybe, you know, the uncommitted delegates understood this. There was as much a moral gap between what I saw in Chicago, that is to say, to go on stage and promote these values of diversity, humanity, big tent, and to exclude the people whose families are being bombed right now, as it was in the early 1960s and, you know, before, when the Democratic Party, you know, claimed to be for the working man and the working person, while millions of workers all through the South were effectively in a system of indentured servitude, and they refused to give those people political representation. It is a gigantic moral gulf that is troubling, disappointing, heartbreaking, and deeply, deeply personally upsetting.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, award-winning journalist, author, professor, his new book is The Message. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago.
its members or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. Thank you. What a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work and for you too is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, after all the choices that they have, they decide that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects is a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them, and I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes, but just in a different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter. And Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. At one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 1958, something like that, man. It's 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He's one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether at a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to 5 or 6 people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio when a quintet was playing in the studio, and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in the group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I play does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and his musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space, where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling and sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound, by the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away and according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from a David Gage in New York, yeah, a realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, mm-hmm, all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quartet is, quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote, his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take, Richard, if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, mm-hmm, say the big top five orchestras, mm-hmm, from 1957 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you find, mm-hmm, on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical, mm-hmm, songs and other. I have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, mm-hmm, high school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to play the Handel, the Hallelujah Chorus, or mm-hmm, they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those kinds of groups, and I play as many as I can as my schedule allows and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past 2 and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, and this is my concern day, I guess, is that most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, and they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings. You know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm a Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list less, two more records. I've got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play. Just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Don't forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to remind you that everything that's said today on the program is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members, and strictly the views of myself. So welcome. Welcome to The Angry Young Man, that wonderful, amazing time of the week, depending on whether or not it's a Tuesday or a Thursday. Welcome, and that statement might not make sense right now, but this does re-air on Tuesdays. So, hello Tuesday people, you're in the future. Now, I was supposed to have a guest today. Said guest has played hooky. It's okay, you know, I don't blame them. It's beautiful outside for the first day in a couple days. I mean, you don't have to look too far outside the window to see that it's sunny and, you know, at least a little warm. I'm glad it's not, you know, torrential downpour like what ended up. I don't know if any of you saw the point flooded. Then those the poor people that mulched PNC Park just completely flooded. Have to go and probably redo that. But I digress. Anyways, so given the fact that this is no longer going to be the discussion that we were going to have, going to be doing something a little different. See, I'm an economics student, and economics is a kind of passion area for me. Definitely enjoy talking about the wonderful, fun world of economics, and that doesn't, you know, I'm pretty sure most people wouldn't agree there, but there's definitely some very pertinent stuff to speak about as it relates to the issue of economic policy currently in the United States. Particularly, you look at the issue of current spending at the federal level and the inflationary results of it. So kind of want to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to speak a little bit about, you know, well, and I'll get into this a little bit. With inflation and massive spending comes the devaluation of the U.S. dollar, which makes it a less attractive method of spending or saving. Where some people have looked to replace that then with investment in either precious metals like gold or silver, and some have gone to digital currencies. Many have decided to go that way, inclusive of our federal government, looking to create a central bank digital currency. I'm talking a little bit about the inherent issues with the central bank digital currency and why we should be afraid of it, potentially. Or concerned at the very least. Not necessarily afraid, but maybe concerned at the outset. Definitely some scary things in there. But also, then finally kind of wrapping around, talking about how this all goes back to the grander issue of banking. Not just central banking, but banking on the whole. So, if this all kind of resonates with you, stay tuned. But if it doesn't resonate with you, I believe that this is something that you could listen to. It would be fun to listen to, potentially. Keep an open ear. See what we have going on. But before we do launch into that, also just letting you know that WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full coffee bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches and breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Also, just a couple shows here on WRCT. We have From Here to Eternity. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airwaves of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back to the 80s you never knew with DJ Tony Tunes from here to eternity, Mondays at 4 p.m. Also, we have Kaleidoscope. Tune into Kaleidoscope, an eclectic hour of music with your very own DJ Kate, Mondays at 8 p.m., only on WRCT Pittsburgh. Add to the colorful mix by calling in requests. Well, anyways, now that we have that out of the way, let's get to the meat of the program for the day, talking a little bit about these wonderful, wonderful economic topics. So, inflation. Basically, one of the large issues that we've had in the past 3 or so years is massive, massive deficit spending. Now, deficit spending, spending more than we're taking in taxes. And you can't look at this issue without looking at specific examples like our Inflation Reduction Act, which, surprise, surprise, did not help inflation, as well as the infrastructure bill that was passed. Both have a very large price tag on it. We're talking trillions of dollars. Now, we take in a sizable amount of tax revenue, an egregious amount, but the amount of money that we were spending on these two bills combined is not something that we could really put the gap with our tax revenue. So the expenditure is outpacing what we're taking in. So as a result, we have to borrow. We have to borrow the money to spend, which inevitably results in the Federal Reserve needing to kind of keep pace by printing more money. Now, what does this mean? If you print more money, you are going to devalue the currency. And the reason this being is if you have, like, if you have, so the basic economic supply and demand, there's demand for money. And if more people are demanding more money, the less money there is, the more valuable each individual dollar is because there's less of it in circulation. You print more money, more people are going to be able to get $1 on average, which means that they're going to be able to acquire it, and they're going to have less of a desire to kind of put up more value to that because there's just more of it there. So you kind of scale this out. You flood the economy with new money. Money is worth less because there's just more money, hence the issue of inflation. You slowly lose the value of your currency. And this is something that tended to not be a crazy issue for a while, mainly because we had the gold standard. Now, the gold standard basically ended up tying the value of our currency to a set amount of gold that we had in our national reserve. So you could never really go beyond whatever amount of gold you were able to put into our reserves. That severely limited the ability to grow the money supply and protected, at least in some ways, the buying power of the dollar, the purchasing power of the dollar, which made it easier to save, which made it easier to be able to afford things. And what happened was, as we moved away from it and we moved to what we call now fiat currency, which is basically the currency is worth as much as we're willing to say it's worth. It's not backed by anything except the, quote, full faith and credit of the United States. Now, the full faith and credit of the United States, because the United States is a large country with a large military, means a lot. But it's interesting to think if, you know, there's a lot that we're able to get away with as a country of our size and influence, particularly as it comes to our monetary and fiscal policy. If we're able to exert our influence abroad, we're able to get away with irresponsible policy when it comes to that. We don't have to worry about the dollar being undercut because the dollar is used in most as the means of international exchange. We don't need to worry about the issues that are inherent to printing this money and devaluing it because people aren't moving away from it. What are they going to turn to? And this is where countries like Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa have moved to form the BRICS currency union, to try to counteract that. Hasn't become an issue that's too big just yet. We'll keep an eye on it. But all this to say that we're kind of digging ourselves into a deeper and deeper hole where it hasn't necessarily become apparent how bad it is yet. Just because we're living in the kind of rose-tinted reality of being the world's superpower still. And we don't have to worry about our consequences for our actions just yet economically. But there's a really good Ludwig von Mises quote. Now, he is someone that I'm going to reference a little bit today because he says a lot of good stuff as it relates to this issue of inflation, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and the necessity to be prudent and exercise restraint when it comes to these issues. So he said something which I think explains this. And it's talking specifically about the economic policy of the United States. If I can find it really quick, it is something that I go back to often. And I think I've got it right here. Yes. So one of the privileges of the rich man is that he can afford to be foolish much longer than the poor man. And this is the situation of the United States. The financial policy of the United States is very bad and getting worse. Perhaps the United States can afford to be foolish a bit longer than some other countries. And this was said in the 1970s by Milton Friedman. Not Milton Friedman, sorry. Von Mises. Milton Friedman is someone I'm going to bring up a little bit later. But von Mises outlined this issue just as it was getting bad. Von Mises is unfortunately no longer with us. But if he saw how things were looking right now, it would be a mix of I told you so and shock and panic. and I think that's a valid response because what we're looking at is a slow descent into – like we're not facing the consequences of the pit that we've dug ourselves into. But eventually we're going to have to climb ourselves out because we're going to realize that we've run out of food and water and we're slowly starving at the bottom of this pit that we've dug for ourselves. And we're going to have to climb out. And it's going to be a very painful process when that eventually hits us. So we've continued to pursue this. And it's concerning that it's both parties that pursue this agenda of massive fiscal irresponsibility. You have Republicans that will, you know, cry fiscal responsibility under a Democratic administration, which is valid. Because Joe Biden, as president, has spent a ludicrous amount of money when he had the Democratic trifecta at the beginning of his term. But we can't look at that and then also not look at the fact that under Republican administrations, the amount of money that's been thrown at the military and other projects which have cost billions of dollars are also equally as fiscally irresponsible. And we've kind of just gotten to this back and forth of spend. And even when we're, you know, looking at, you know, Republicans who are claiming that they're for fiscal responsibility, they're not acting on it. And they're, you know, it's just kind of an issue of the rot of the system in some ways, but it will come back to bite us. All that to say, that's kind of the issue on the fiscal irresponsibility side and what that ends up looking like for, you know, what is perpetuating the issue. But what does that look like in the real terms? What does that look like for people who have to deal with the results of inflationary policy? I think we saw a lot of that as a result of the COVID era inflation. You know, it was a very real thing to see prices increase for gas, for our groceries, for things like that. And that was a very real example of that. But this has been happening for a very long time, even pre-COVID. You saw the issue of prices. If you looked back at, like, how much did a soda cost in the 1950s? And it was, like, 50 cents. But now it was, like, $2.50, about 30, 40 years later. And it had a lot to do with the diminishing buying power of the dollar. And it only got worse as we abandoned the gold standard. I mean, it's only getting worse. Things are only getting more expensive. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's just ongoing diminishing purchasing power of the dollar. Now, this will happen naturally over time, and it should happen on a very long slope trajectory. But it's happening very quickly. And when it happens very quickly, people cannot catch up. Wages do not catch up. Wages increase over time alongside these prices, and that's how it should happen. As there are just more people, we need more money in circulation in order to accommodate for that. But that's a very critical thing to understand, that the pie is not finite when it comes to the ability for people to get money. The pie always grows, and there's enough room at the table for everybody. But when the pie is not growing and everything else is, it becomes very difficult to hold on. And that's kind of what we've seen as a result of the COVID-era inflationary policy. Inflationary result of COVID-era policy. And it's not getting any better. It's getting worse as we've kind of dropped the facade of trying to be at least fiscally somewhat responsible. The price tags we have on government projects now are still at COVID levels of spending, which, you know, even Keynesians who say that we need to spend our way out of the, you know, pandemics and the recessions, are kind of looking at what we're still doing and they're like, you know, pump the brakes, even that's too far. And it's continued to be, this is why you'll have issues where, you know, prices are still high and wages are not catching up. People are arguing for government to step in. And what you do by kind of artificially pushing this along faster is something that's very critical to understand is the market does not move as one unit. The market is fluid. The market moves in kind of an ebb and flow. And that's the thing that's important about inflation too. Inflation does not happen all at once. Inflation kind of spreads out across the market. And that's one of the major issues with, you know, when we print a lot of money, the people that are closest to the printer are the ones that benefit. They get the immediate effect of having more money in their pockets, but prices have not adjusted in many parts of the economy. So they have an advantage over most people who have not had the opportunity to gain capital. By the time that effect hits wages for people that are furthest away from the faucet, people who are working in education, people who are working in like things that are very far away from the financial sectors, those people lose out most. And that's where, you know, the issue of, you know, how do you deal with that? You want to keep inflation low, because then you end up with this disjointed system. And trying to push for increases in wages when that effect hasn't leveled out only exacerbates the issue, because you end up hurting the people that need to pay out these salaries, who are themselves also suffering from high costs. So it's a whole jumbled mess. And a lot of people, as a result, are trying to turn away from traditional American currency, particularly as it comes to digital currencies, Bitcoin, your Dogecoins, things like that. And that's become very popular in the past 10 years. Some people are not crazy about it still as an investment. Some people are. But what's concerning is how the government has attempted to move itself onto this bandwagon as well by establishing a central bank digital currency. Now, it's functionally the same as other digital currencies. But the concerning part comes in when you see the reports that have been put together that argue for this to be a primary currency, to move away from cash. Now, we've been moving away from cash for a while. There are cashless businesses where you cannot pay in cash, which I think is ridiculous. I whenever I go to a business that does not accept cash, I am deeply, deeply appalled. That's just a personal thing, but most people don't pay with cash. As someone who's worked at in food service, where you're working either a cashier or waiting on tables, most people don't pay with cash. They pay with card. So it's we've already kind of moved mostly away from cash, and this is where the government has seen an opportunity to introduce an official currency which solely runs digitally. And this allows them the ability to monitor and control currency with greater ease. Now, when money was just little silver coins that we traded and were printed out by the, you know, like countries of the times, the mints of France and Great Britain, stuff like that, you know, that was very hard to control. There was no monetary controls there. And as we moved towards the, you know, modern monetary system, it became easier to control money, especially once we ditched the gold standard. Government could print money, relax the monetary supply, tighten it, do whatever they needed to do with it. Monetary controls became very easy. But the thing that they couldn't do until recently when we started to digitize our transactions was monitor where money was going with greater ease. And that's what you are able to do when it comes to digital transfers and stuff like that. Government is able to much more effectively see where is the money going, how is it flowing, who's spending what, who has what, and try to affect monetary policy with greater degrees of information. There is a lack of privacy in monetary in fiscal exchange now. And with central bank digital currency, it only gets worse. Because when the money is no longer partially physical, when the money is all digital, the gloves are off. Everything is subject to the control of the government. One of the scarier things, outside of complete lack of privacy, there is no privacy in transaction once we go to central bank digital currency. Every transaction is seen. There is absolutely no privacy. Now, some people may, you know, make the, I call it the Patriot Act argument, that, oh, you're supporting, you know, terrorism by trying to push back on efforts to clamp down on terrorism. Oh, you support, you know, money laundering or things like this if you don't want government to be able to see where money is going. No. The statement of the traditional, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, is ignorant of the, you know, the desire of those in power to control what is being done, to kind of groom societal behavior by discouraging certain things. And that's something that's already done and can be done even further with a central bank digital currency. The thing that you can do with central bank digital currency that you can't do with any other currency is the scariest thing, I think. Negative interest. Now, positive interest is a very intuitive thing. You know, you put your money in the bank and over time it accumulates interest and you can like get a little extra bonus on top of whatever you put in for holding your money and being a wise citizen who's prudent and saves. Now, say the government wants to increase expenditure, like they want more people to spend money. They can institute negative interest on money. And if you hold on to your money, if you don't spend your money, it loses value. It is a direct tax on your savings, more than just the depreciation of buying and purchasing power. They can literally just make your money be worth less for holding on to it or any other reason. That's scary. That's very scary. And that's something I always point to and say, you know, be weary of this when people argue for central bank digital currency, because that's to have a lack of control over your own finances, be at the whim of other people's desires and goals. That is a scary and stark lack of freedom. You know, we're so quick to accept convenience and safety as things that we will exchange our freedom for. You know, we're willing to give the government the ability to, you know, spy on people for the stated purpose of combating terrorism. But as Edward Snowden pointed out, by whistleblowing on the NSA, the Obama administration was going way beyond just spying on terrorists and spying on American citizens, innocent American citizens. We have, you know, like I spoke about last week, the TikTok ban, you know, for the stated goal of combating Chinese interests, but giving the executive the ability to ban any, you know, stated foreign adversary that has social media presence. And that's open ended. And that's the same issue with this, you know, stated convenience of being able to be completely digital and not deal with the hassle of physical currency, the outdated, you know, paper exchange that we have going on. You have to be very careful with the Faustian bargain of safety for freedom, or freedom for safety, or freedom for convenience. I forget exactly where this is. I believe it was something that was said in Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where the issue of slowly delegating to government the responsibilities that we as individuals take on by virtue of being free people, taking care of our own expenses, trying to provide for ourselves, things that we at the outset were doing for ourselves but slowly delegated to government, you know, save my retirement fund for me, government, you know, take care of education for me, government, do these things for me so I don't have to worry about them. I want the convenience of ignorant bliss, of being able to kind of just float around and let you take care of it. It was almost kind of likened to, you know, it's the nanny state. Let government be our shepherd as we're guided as blissfully ignorant sheep. That's the inevitable outcome as we slowly delegate our freedoms away to government for convenience and safety. And that's the issue that is inherent to a lot of what our conception of the role of government has become. And that is inherent to the issue of dealing with central bank digital currency and monetary and fiscal freedom. It's a cautionary tale of, you know, just how much are you willing to give up until you realize that it's very hard to give things away. No, it's very, very easy to give things hard. Apologies. It's very hard to get things back once you've given them away. It's very hard to gain back your monetary and fiscal freedom once you've given it away to government. It's very hard to get your privacy back once you've given it to government. So, on this somber and kind of doomy note over here, I mean, you tuned into a show called The Angry Young Man, who's kind of ranting and raving. You'd expect a little bit of a kind of Debbie Downer attitude to in a lot of ways, but I have hope. You know, I definitely think that a lot of people post Snowden kind of woke up to a lot of this issue and have kind of lost it in the past 10 years, but I don't believe it's ever too late to turn back, to kind of acknowledge that there's a necessity to reclaim a lot of what we've delegated to government mistakenly. You know, there's a lot of responsibility tied up in freedom. Freedom is power. And in the wise words of Uncle Ben in Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. We have the absolute distinct opportunity and the privilege of being able to be free in this country. Something that in most countries, not even half of what we guarantee is guaranteed. But we need to be ready to stand up and hold that. You know, hold on to it, cling on to it, because as so many other people in other parts of the world know, freedom is a very precious thing. And we shouldn't be so quick to give it up for the sake of convenience. On that note, I wish you all a very happy rest of your day, a very wonderful rest of your day. take care, God bless, and stay free. Because you could do that here. And it really is a beautiful thing. Ciao.
You are entering another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and of sound, but also of mind. This is a dimension that few people enter, and from which even fewer return. There is a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, WRCT 88.3 FM Stereo. It could be worse. You could be entering the Twilight Zone. But there are other alternatives.